The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
It's Thursday and rolling right along, and it's time to bring you up to date on the influenza issue. It's not a human influenza problem at this point. It's bird flu, and it is now here in the U.S. We anticipated that. Henry Nyman is right on it as usual. Dr. Nyman, are you there?
I'm here, Jeff.
Welcome back, Henry.
Okay, and yeah, I think today it would be good to talk about this, the bird flu that's in southern Tennessee and northern Alabama. It seems to be spreading, and there's a few things that are still a little bit fuzzy about exactly what's there, but it is coming into focus. And, you know, I wanted to talk about that outbreak primarily tonight. It ties in a little bit. It is H7N9, but you know, I wanted to back up a little bit and clarify that this is not the H7N9. This is China. It's the same serotype, but this is an American version versus the Asian version in China.
Have we seen this version before here?
There have been H7N9s in the past. It's low pass. Exactly how related this one is to the H7N9 that's been seen in the U.S. is a little bit unclear. These sequences have not been released yet for the isolates in Tennessee. But they have been described as, you know, when they first came out, the USDA issued an alert to stakeholders, and they specifically said that the initial report just said it was H7, and they said it was high path H7, but it wasn't related to the H7N9 in China. There's actually two versions of H7N9 in China now. There's a high path and a low path. And they were very clear in stating that this was a North American H7. And, you know, I wanted to just kind of touch on that before we go too far, just to explain the difference, because there's a lot of confusion on the internet. And then when it was announced that it was N9, it was H7N9, then you know, some websites started talking about it being from China or being the same as China, or worrying that that the announcements that it was North American were confused somehow. They were just saying that, and they didn't really know. And, you know, those rumors on the internet are just, you know, made by people that either, you know, have no idea what they're talking about. Or
there's a lot of those out there.
To deceive.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Please. We lost quite a few people in Egypt, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, and I've forgotten how long ago now. They had a bird flu variant, did they not?
They had H5N1. And, you know, now H5N1 kind of ties in with this in the sense that these are spread by wild birds. And H5N1... really spread out of Asia back in 2005, and that was the Qinghai version that was initially identified in the spring of 2005 at Qinghai Lake in central China, and that that version, which is called Clade 2.2, ended up migrating up north for the summer and showed up in Siberia, where there's where wild birds, a bunch of flyways overlap, as well as Mongolia, as well as the border with Kazakhstan and Siberia. And none of those three countries at the time had ever reported the Asian high path version of H5N1.
Uh-huh.
And all three ended up confirming that it A, was H5N1, and B, it was the Qinghai strain. And so really in the summer of 2005, it was already clear that the virus that was in central China in the spring had gotten into the wild birds. These birds can migrate, you know, literally barheaded geese can go 1,000 miles in 24 hours, so they can move the virus a long distance. And that it was expected that if the wild birds could spread it, it would end up showing up in Siberia and Mongolia, because it's known that the wild birds go up there for the summer to breed and to migrate, and flyways were well known. And all the major flyways really kind of converge there. So there's one that goes down the east coast of Asia. There's one that goes north-south into India. And then there's a couple that go to the west and go through Europe and down through the Middle East and then on to Western Africa. And, you know, first Northern Africa and then Western Africa. And so it was pretty clear that if the H5N1 was, you know, in at the intersection of all these flyways, that come fall, the virus could spread pretty dramatically. And that's exactly what happened. It ended up, first it was in Europe, and then it was in the Middle East, and then it was in Egypt, and then it was in Western Africa. And the version in Egypt ended up becoming endemic. And so they never really got rid of the Qinghai strain. The Qinghai strain pretty much died out in these other areas, but it's still circulating in Egypt today, and is still causing human cases today. And so, and it is the H5N1. Now, what's attracted attention this year is the H5N8, and this has to do with the evolution of the H5 in Asia, primarily in China. There were a couple different versions back in 2005. There was this Qinghai strain, which is not very common anymore. It's predominantly just in Egypt. And then there's this Fujian strain, which was initially in China, and then that started, it got into the wild birds, and that started spreading, and it kind of went up the coast to South Korea and Japan, and then once it got to those two countries, it got in the same flyways that carried it to Europe. And there were a couple different versions of the Fujian strain, and then the one that was initially as identified with human cases, ended up showing up a few years later, and then it kind of did reassortment, and it was predominantly H5N8 in China. There are actually several different versions. There's H5N8 and H5N6 are the two that get the most attention, because H5N6 has also caused human fatalities in China. And H5N8 was the virus that ended up crossing over to North America, and that's what caused all the problems in late 2014 in British Columbia, and then in the
spring. We lost a lot of poultry.
2015.
A lot of poultry.
Yeah, and it was in Iowa, it really hit the layers, so it affected egg market. There were some restaurants that couldn't get eggs. The price of eggs went up dramatically. And then in Wisconsin, it hit the turkey industry. In Wisconsin's the number one turkey producer in the U.S. And Iowa is the number one egg producer in the U.S. And it was the same H5N8, once it got to the U.S., ended up reassorting with local wild birds. And as a result, there were actually three different serotypes in the United States. There was H5N8, there was H5N2, and there was H5N1. Now, the H5N1, the N1 wasn't from Asia. The N1 actually was from North America. And these distinctions are very easy to make if you have the sequence. If you have the virus,
right,
and you have those sequences, the usually Asia and North America are kept fairly separate. So the wild birds in North America pretty much go up and down from Alaska and Canada all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and but they they generally don't do a lot of jumping over to Asia. And similarly, the virus in Asia does have a history of crossing over to Europe. And so a lot of times it's called Eurasian strain. And more recently, with the H5N1 in 2005, it ended up spreading even further in the Middle East and in that Africa. But as a result of having these barriers, which were pretty strong in the past, this outbreak that I mentioned in 2014, that was certainly the first widespread introduction of the Asian high death H5 into North America. And there's been some speculation that that it might have actually been facilitated to a degree from global warming, because these birds like to, when they migrate, they like to migrate over open water. It kind of gives them protection where they can land, and they don't, like landing on the snow. And with the polar ice cap melting, there was a lot more open water to to cross from Asia to North America.
What birds would be bringing it, Henry? What particular species of birds would be bringing it across? What birds would be the carriers?
There's dabbling ducks. There's a whole range of ducks that are on the water and kind of
dabbling
to get their food.
Dabbling ducks. Sounds like a TV sitcom.
Ducks. Yeah. Well, they the virus likes dabbling ducks. I don't know if they saw them on TV or not, but that's their
pretty funny.
Their ticket to ride, so to speak, and that kind of boosts the virus around.
Uh-huh.
And so those are are fairly common for transporting them. In Europe, the detection of the virus is frequently found in mute swans, because the mute swans are susceptible to the virus and not so much to transmit the virus over long distances, but more with regard to being affected by the virus and then dying and being kind of obvious because they're big and dead. And so a lot of the H5N8 that's been reported in wild birds back in 2005, as well as this year, especially in Europe, are reported in these swans. And some of these reports are, you know, there's not one or two, it's like a dozen or 15 or 20. And they only report the ones that actually are positive. And so it can, be quite lethal for those birds. And having a number of them dead on the lake kind of gets the attention of, the citizens that report them, and they get tested and that's where they find them. But what was interesting about the movement to North America was this reassortment, and it came up with three different versions, and that didn't just result in a new N. So it wasn't, H5N8 became H5N1 or H5N2, but there were also internal genes. And again, if you have the virus and you have the sequence, it's very easy to make these types of distinctions because the North American version of the different gene segments and the different serotypes are very different than the Asian version. And so if you've got the virus, you could take each of the 18 segments and you just kind of do a comparison and see what is it most closely related to. Mm-hmm. And it comes up real clear. I mean, when you do these tests, there's no ambiguity. It's straightforward. You could take these 8 segments for the, the H5N2, for instance. If you took the H5, that matches the Fujian H5 that's, been in China since 2005, so all of the matches are H5 and from Asia. And then if you take the N2, that ends up matching the N2 found in North American wild birds, even though there is an Asian N2. There's N2 in wild birds in Asia. And you could actually see that with that outbreak. The outbreak that happened in Canada and the United States really traced back to a crane in Kagoshima, Japan, actually. And the H5N8, all 18 segments were related to that crane sequence. And then the same thing happened in Taiwan, which had a massive outbreak at the same time. They had H5N8, and also traced back to this, more closely related to this crane from Japan. Japan actually had three different versions. One was like the outbreak in South Korea. The other one was more of a local version, and the third one was this crane. And then you could see, how this reassortment happened. That in Taiwan, there was H5N8, but then there was also H5N2 and H5N3. And in those cases, the N2 and the N3 came from wild birds in Asia. And they had some other internal genes that came from wild birds in Asia. Even the Asian sequences could be distinguished from this crane. So you could say, well, it's an Asian sequence, but it's distinct from the crane. And even though the crane is also an Asian sequence, it's a little bit closer, but they're still easy to distinguish. And then it's much easier to distinguish the North American version. So you take all 8 segments and you take a look to see what it was like and most closely related. The H5N8, all 18 segments were Asian. And then for the H5N2, it was, I think, three of the segments were North American. And for the H5N1, four of the segments were North American. So making those types of distinctions is very easy. And And the same thing applies for the A7 and 9. The A7 and 9, that this sequence hasn't been released yet, but actually, St. Jude just released a whole series of H7 wild bird sequences that were collected in, I'd say, mostly 2014, 2015. And I think that was done in anticipation of this sequence that's going to be released from the A7 and 9. Mm-hmm. And there was also the A7 and 2. I think we mentioned that. That's in the cast in New York. And that's another example of H7, which is North American. That was like an H7 and 2 outbreak that had happened on the East Coast about 10 years ago or so. So these viruses that are in the news, the H7N2 in cats, as well as the H7N9 that are apparently brought by wild birds, are all North American and are related to H7s that have been seen in the past.
Don't lose your thought. We need to tell people what the problem here is. And the problem is the wild birds bring H7 and 9 in this case, or whichever, and it infects poultry. They fly over a poultry farm, whether it's chickens or turkeys, it doesn't matter. And the animals become infected. And the only treatment is mass culling. They have to all be killed. I mean, we're talking about ultimately maybe millions of birds in some of these things. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of birds have to be killed. And people will say, well, why? It's not always fatal in the birds, which it apparently isn't. So why do they always have to be entirely wiped out? That's a question I've gotten from people.
Okay. You want me to do it now or after the commercial?
We got a break coming up in a minute, but that's just something I wanted to put out there because people want to know, what's the deal? If it doesn't kill the birds dead, or if it's not directly communicable to us, why kill them all? And that's a question.
Are big ifs, and I'll go through the ifs.
Yeah.
It is communicable to humans, and it does change from low path to high path.
Now, this is what we've covered for so many years, and I need to bring that out again. I think it's time.
But that's actually happened in this current outbreak. There's both low pass and high pass. And I can go through that after the break. So those are split up, and it actually did happen. And that's why low path and high path are both reportable diseases. And it's known that for H7 and for H5, particularly if they get into a poultry farm, then they can change and pick up this polybasic plebiscite through recombination. And then it becomes high past. And once it becomes high past, it does kill off all the birds. And it kills them all very, very quickly.
All right.
And
we'll do that in just a couple minutes. Hold on. Dr. Henry Nyman and I will be right back. And Henry always bringing us up to date. It's a little scientific at times, but it is listened to worldwide. He is considered to be at the top of his field. And so we will continue and answer some questions for you, which I just put out there in just a couple minutes. Okay, and we're back with Henry, and we're going to find out some things that we've talked about for years and years, but it's always good to review these things. Go ahead, Henry, please.
Okay. As I mentioned before the break, both low path H5 and H7 are both reportable diseases. The low path for the birds generally, as you said, doesn't kill the birds. They may have a reduction in egg production. They may, look a little bit, their feathers are a little bit ruffled. They really don't look like they're that happy or healthy. But they generally will recover from the low path. the problem is that, particularly on the farms, the birds are very high density. That these barns, I mean, I can tell pretty much how many birds are on the farm just by looking at Google Maps and seeing how big the barn is. And and these barns typically would have about 10,000 birds apiece. And so these farms where there's 80,000 birds that get culled, that's just basically in 8 barns. Each one's got about 10,000 birds. Hmm. And so when it's at that high density, it's very easy for the virus to pass from bird to bird. And so the viral loads start getting very high, and the level of the number of birds infected gets very high. And when you get that type of situation, then you set up an opportunity for the virus to recombine and to actually pick up a series of basic amino acids. And if those basic amino acids go into the cleavage site, then the virus goes from low path to high path. And when it's high path, particularly when it's H5 or H7, which are known to have this happen, the virus then does kill the birds, and it again spreads through the birds very, very quickly, you're going to end up losing the birds no matter if you cull them before it spreads or after. And when you start getting high levels of virus like that, you do have the potential for human cases. And the examples, one of the best examples really happened in 2003 in the Netherlands, when they had an H7N7 outbreak. And that was high path. And back in 2003, since it was high path, it was devastating these farms. It spread very quickly farm to farm, and it spread very quickly within the farms. Mm-hmm. And the birds were dying off at very high frequencies. To control it, they call it stamping out. They basically cull all the birds on the farms and isolate those and restrict movement of poultry, et cetera. And back in 2003, they wore uniforms, but they didn't wear goggles. And so their eyes were basically exposed to the birds that they were culling. And 89 of the cullers actually got infected with the virus. And wow. So they had H7N7 infections. Uh-huh. And one of them, a veterinarian who was actually swabbing and testing the birds, ended up dying. And so that was really the first fatal bird flu case that wasn't H5. And so this is H7N7. It ended up getting this, I talked about E627K, which is in the PB2 gene, which allows the virus to grow at a lower temperature, more in line with humans. And this veterinarian actually did have E627K in the virus that was isolated from him. And so it ended up with a death. It ended up with 89 cullers who were PCR confirmed as having H7N7. Most of them, it wasn't serious. I mean, the only death was a veterinarian. The other cullers, had flu-like symptoms. A lot of them just had the infections in their eyes. They had conjunctivitis. But then when they tested contacts for H7 antibodies, they had developed a fairly sensitive antibody test. Uh-huh. They found that the contacts of the cullers had been infected, and those contacts of the cullers didn't have contacts with the birds, so they basically got infected by the cullers. And again, they generally had mild symptoms, if they have symptoms at all, and that may, all of this may be related to viral load. So, you know, the virus still didn't grow all that well in humans, especially if it didn't have E67K. And so they might have been affected with a low dose, and with a low dose, they fought off the infection, but they made antibodies. And then when they tested their blood to see if they had antibodies, they had like 1,000 contacts were positive. Mm-hmm. So the virus did indeed go from the birds to the colors and from the colors to contacts. The virus wasn't quite as adapted to humans as it could be. And the contacts really were generally asymptomatic, and the colors generally had fairly mild disease, but at least one of them died. And there was one reported case. You know, I mm-hmm. don't think there was necessarily evidence that more than one died. Mm-hmm. But that just shows how easily an H7 can go human to human, especially at a low level where they managed to infect the host but didn't really cause major illness.
Right.
But then, in contrast to that, there's the H7N9 in China. Now, the H7N9 in China is from a low path H7. So that virus does not kill the birds. It really silently spreads. But that virus has a couple of these changes that have been identified in these gain of function studies, which are changes that allow the virus to transmit mammal to mammal. These are studies that are done with ferrets. And these were to identify changes that would allow the virus to go from a ferret in one cage to a ferret mm-hmm. in an adjacent cage with no contact between them, so it would have to be airborne to go from one ferret to the other. And they identified the changes that were involved, and they were able to achieve this with just making three changes in the virus, two of them in the receptor binding domain at positions 226 and 228, and one of that PB2 gene, that E627K. And it turns out that the virus in China has two out of those three changes. So it has the change of position 226 in the receptor binding domain that favors mammalian cells, and it has E627K, at least in the human cases. And so you've got a virus that's pretty close to spreading human to human. And these outbreaks, there have been small clusters. And so there have been, the clusters have only been two or three in a group. You know, they're usually family members.
Right.
And so, you know, one more change, and that one's going to be devastating because the case fatality rate is around 30%. So it's low path in birds. Mm-hmm. They don't get sick. You know, if they get sick, it's low egg production, but they silently spread. And in the case of this H7, it's already got these other two mammalian adaptations. And actually, there was another one that showed up, which is was the loss of this glycosylation site, and they've got that also. So if you count that one, there's really four changes. That change was found by passaging it in the ferrets. So there are really four changes, and these viruses have three out of the four.
Uh-huh.
So they're very close to being, you know, transmitting human to human, but they are in a low path H7N9. And now in China, they not only have low path H7N9, but now they have high path H7N9. And the high path, the number, it was first reported just a month or two ago. And it was actually identified by a traveler from Taiwan who went to Guangdong province, and he mm-hmm. came back. Mm-hmm. And he was diagnosed once he returned. And initially he had mild symptoms, and then he went critical, and then he died. And so he died, and then there were subsequently three more cases that were reported in China, and two out of those three died. And in fact, the only one that didn't die was in a cluster, and she was infected by her older sister who did die. And so she might have had a somewhat lower dose because she was infected human to human. And she didn't have the E627K, whereas the three that died did have the E627K. And then to make matters worse, they all, including the one that survived, had Tamiflu-resistant markers. So they had the virus from three out of the four. The older sister, they just know she was age seven. They didn't bother isolating the virus from her. But for the three that they identified, all three had Tamiflu resistance. So you got two different viruses in China, one of which is low pass, but it's got this receptor binding domain change. The other one is high pass, doesn't have the receptor binding domain change, but is Tamiflu resistant. And so both of those are very bad combinations, you know, and especially when they're both co-circulating in Guangdong province. The high pass without the receptor binding domain can recombine with the low pass that does have that, and then you could end up with a virus that's high pass and has the receptor binding domain change and has the E627K and has lost the glycosylation site. So that alone may allow that to transmit because, you know, like I said, the high path, there have only been four cases, but two out of those four cases were a cluster. And so you might have a higher rate of transmission human to human, and that may be simply due to the fact that you have more virus. That, with it being high path, the poultry may have more virus, and then
so
the
heavier load
and
the
higher
and
that, viral load.
I see. Yeah.
And they end up getting sicker, so that in this case you've got three out of four died, so that's a 75% case fatality rate. Low sample size, but very high rate. And you got one cluster, so two out of the four cases were in a cluster. So both of those are bad combinations. And like I say, most of the cases are with the low path. So even though it's low path in chickens, it does infect humans, and it's got a 30% case fatality rate in humans, and it's adapted to humans. And so the virus is floating around there, not only can jump to humans, but it's kind of one change away from transmitting, you know, much more efficiently human to human. And there's already a couple hundred people that have died in China. Now getting back to the U.S., which is where I was going to focus, there's the H7N9, and that was initially identified in Tennessee. It was in Lincoln County, Tennessee, and it was at a poultry plant. It was a poultry plant by Tyson's Foods. And that was reported, you know, initially, the initial reports was that it's North American strain. It's not the H7N9 that's in China, but it is an H7, and H7s, you know, there's a concern because the H7N2 in New York is transmitting in cats, and cats are mammals, and H7 has always had kind of a mammalian component that equine influenza is. There were outbreaks. It's now mostly H3N8, but it used to be H7N7. So H7 has been found in horses, and H7 has been found in cats, and both of those are mammals, and that's a concern. That an H7,
and that's this season they've found that this year.
The horses and cats. The horses are old. Most horse influenza now is H3N8. So that's kind of replaced the H7N7. The H7s were in horses back in the 60s or so. So that was fairly common back then. They were both circulating. The equine influenza was generally either H7N7 or H3N8, and now pretty much all the equine influenza of this report is H3N8, but that's jumped to dog sounds. The dogs is H3N8, and there's an avian H3N2 that's in dogs also. So a lot of these viruses that have in the past been found in birds can adapt and can get established in mammals, and once they've adapted and get established, they spread. So these outbreaks of H3N8 and H3N2 in dogs are mm-hmm. fairly widespread now. Mm-hmm. Those two versions haven't been identified.
Are they? How often? What's the mortality rate in dogs, for example? Do we know?
I think it's higher for dogs in kennels because, again, it's a system where you can have higher viral loads.
Yep.
I think companions that don't spend as much time in the kennels is not that high of a rate as far as the deaths are concerned, but it can spread fairly easily, especially in these kennels, and you could have major outbreaks. There's actually a vaccine now that's being offered for dogs, and some kennels won't take dogs unless they're vaccinated now. Mm-hmm. So, but that vaccine just came on the market, I think, this year.
Whether it works or not, it seems like an awfully new product, but okay. At least they're trying.
Well, the vaccines, I know you have some aversion to the vaccines, but there are a lot of illnesses that...
It isn't the vaccine so much, Henry. It's the adjuvants and the other things that they put into them, like aspartame. What the hell are they putting aspartame in vaccines for? A mercury. I mean, that's the part that I can't deal with.
Yeah, well, these are some that are in the adjuvant. A lot of the ones in the U.S. don't have that, including the flu. There's nothing in there.
Right. I've read a lot of ingredients on these things, and I wish I had your expertise to figure out what the heck they were doing putting them in there, but there's some strange things in some of these.
Aspartame is just an amino acid. I mean, that's what you make all your proteins from. So,
okay.
In any event, the vaccines are generally fairly effective. There are a lot of childhood diseases. I mean, when I was young, everybody would get the mumps and the measles and the German measles, rubella. And now everybody gets
you know what they're doing now with vaccines, Henry?
For MMR.
You're going to want to hear this. Did I send you the article? Very well written, that there really is no virus for measles. I'll send it to you. It's very interesting.
No virus.
That's a contention.
This sounds like an internet rumor.
I know. Let me just send it to you, and you can go just look at it. Tell me what you think.
Well, here I can tell you from firsthand experience because I did my graduate work in virology.
No, I know.
I used to grow viruses, and you can concentrate.
I'm not saying there is or isn't. I'm saying I just came across an article that I'll send to you.
Well, let me just tell you two things about this. A, I grew enough virus that when you centrifuge them down in a sucrose gradient, you could actually see the virus with your naked eye.
Wow.
Okay?
Talk about a viral load.
Yeah, that was a viral load. That's right. They concentrate them. You put them on a sucrose gradient.
Wow.
They go right to the 1.16 grams per ml density, and you get a band there, and you can literally see it with your naked eye. But on
that's
top
amazing.
Of being able to actually see the virus in a tube, the viruses have genes that are sequenced. So anybody that's saying the measles virus doesn't exist is, somebody that's just putting out utter nonsense.
Well, I shouldn't have mentioned it because I can't speak to the article. I'll get it. Let me just send it to you for fun.
I can speak to viruses and sequences.
Uh-huh.
And you can just go on the internet. You can go to Gene Bank and you can see lots of sequences from the measles virus.
I believe it. All I'm saying is it was something that came across my desk.
The measles doesn't exist.
Let me send it to you and you can tell me. I don't have the answer. But here's the other one. Do you know that the new viruses that are used in vaccines are now being used as carriers for, rather like Gardasil, new synthetic DNA, which is conferred upon the recipient of the vaccine, and that is supposedly going to engineer antibodies in that person's body from a synthetic DNA, not an attenuated or a dead virus. They're now using the viruses to transport, you know this, synthetic DNA, which takes up... That's wild.
Viruses are real useful. You know, viruses
that's
vectors, and you can stick genes in viruses.
That's exactly what they're doing.
Basically, to replicate and present.
Yep. I didn't know that. I just found that out.
I've always had the stories in the sequence, and you can literally, I think it was the polio. Polio virus was actually made in the lab from scratch using nothing but synthetic RNA that they made. And this was back in the 1980s. So it's something that, technologies has existed for several decades now.
I didn't know anything about that, and I was amazed. So, thank you. All right. Now, you go ahead. Well, we only have about 2 minutes
left.
It was
actually in David Baltimore's lab at MIT, and they did it in the 1980s, and they actually created a complete polio virus that they were able to replicate. And they did it with nothing other than the DNA off the shelf, the nucleotides that came right off the shelf. So nothing was biologic. So anyway, to kind of wrap up where we are in Tennessee and Alabama, this was initially identified in Tennessee, and it was high past. And they had speculated that it did come from wild birds. And then a few days later, this was in Lincoln County. It was identified in Giles County, which is adjacent to Lincoln. It's also in southern Tennessee. But that one was low past. And like I said, they haven't released the sequences yet from either of them. But on a conference call, they did say that the low past was essentially the same as the high past. And so that's another example that I was, as to why do they kill the low past. And in all likelihood, on the basis of those sequences and the proximity of those two farms, it's likely that they were brought by wild birds, but it's very possible that it was brought as low path by wild birds. And so the high path, which was the first one that was identified, may very well have been an example where it originally was low path. It wasn't identified on the farms. And just to give you an idea about the surveillance, because this is another piece of information that came from this outbreak. After these two farms were identified in Tennessee, then three different outbreaks were identified in northern Alabama. One was within a commercial farm that was in Lauderdale County, and it turns out that farm was owned by the same company that had the Giles County in Tennessee. That was Viagen. And so that company owned both of those farms, and whether it transmitted from one to the other by employees that worked at both is not clear. But that was one outbreak. Then there was a backyard farm in Madison County. And then there was a guinea hen at a flea market in Jackson County. So these are three counties in Alabama, all of which are in northern Alabama and share the border with Tennessee. The flea market one, we got a little bit of additional information from that one. That was tested for influenza A. And part of the reason they were doing the testing was the proximity to this outbreak in Tennessee. And it was influenza A positive. And then they tested it for the matrix gene from either H5 or H7. and was matrix gene negative. And the only reason I'm going into this detail,
yeah, we got a roll here.
It gives you an idea of the surveillance because basically only H5 and H7 are reportable. So if it's influenza A positive and negative for the other two, that's usually the end of the testing.
All right.
It's just assumed that it's got the flu, but it's not H5, H7. They're not reportable. And, you know, this is the example that you're asking. They just leave the birds alone and nothing happens further. Because of the proximity, they sent it off to Iowa to be tested. And it was just announced today, indeed, it was H7 and 9. And so so the virus is now in three counties.
It's on the move. It's on the move.
Right.
Yeah, it's on the move. All right, Henry, thank you for that. We're out of time. We're 4 minutes over, but I wanted to give you a chance to get that in. I've sent you that article, and it's entitled, The German Supreme Court Upholds Biologist's Claim That Measles Virus Does Not Exist. It'll be interesting reading for you, so whatever.
I'll tell you one comment. Science and law do not mix.
That's good. Thanks, Henry. All right.
Okay,
be well.
Bye-bye.
Right. Okay. And we'll be right back with hour number two.